With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0.
Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm your host, Sam Sorbo. With me is a fantastic guest that I am so excited to speak to. He almost needs no introduction, but I will say that he has made a journey from a left-leaning person to, or a progressive, I guess you would say, to what he calls a classical liberal. And he says it's been quite the adventure. Joining me now is Dave Rubin. Welcome to the program.
Sam, it's good to be with you. Man, if I've made it to the point where I don't need an introduction, then I think I'm in my retirement phase. Like it's time to go to Del Boca Vista, I think.
Well, you're certainly...
Do that many people know me? Not bad, this YouTube, I guess.
I feel like a lot of people do know you. Am I? Yeah. Maybe I'm the one that's wrong. I just feel like I've known you for a long time and everybody else should as well. So why don't we start there just briefly? Give us a little bit of your journey because you are openly gay and conservative, which is like a no-no. That's not really allowed. Like, what are you thinking?
You're not going to believe this, Sam. I believe that everybody should be treated as their actions dictate and as their thoughts dictate and not on their immutable characteristics. I believe that Black people can have a plethora of ideas and we shouldn't judge them as a monolithic group. And I believe the same thing for gay people and women and all sorts of people. And really your sexual identity or your sexual preference or your gender or the color of your skin really has nothing to do with what you think about the issues. Unfortunately, in the modern left, it has everything to do with what you think about the issues. But in reality, all of us just want to be treated as individuals. So I happen to be gay, you know, like, to me, it's sort of like zippity damn doodah. You know, I've been with my husband for, we've been married for 6 years. We've been together for 10 years, which in straight years, like 30 years or something.
That's what my husband says about us. When we hit the 10-year anniversary, he's like, that's a golden anniversary in Hollywood.
In Hollywood. Yeah. Same calculator, I think. But in essence, I actually don't see much of a conflict between sort of gay and conservative, because generally speaking, conservatives want a society based on individual rights with the government not that much in your way. Now, that's not to say conservatives have been right about all of this stuff. And there was a time, I think, where conservatives were trying to get into people's bedrooms and seeing who they were sleeping with and maybe what they were smoking. But I don't sense that's the future of conservatism. I sense that the future of conservatism is much more, hey, we want all sorts of people in a very wide tent of a party. And maybe some people will be religious. Maybe some people won't. We're going to have some straight people. We're going to have some gay people. But we're here to conserve America. We're here to conserve freedom and the Constitution and all that good stuff. And I'm very much interested in that.
So is that really kind of what inspired your shift, was that you saw that the progressives were, you know what, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. What inspired you to shift?
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple things, but the crux of it was this. Something seemed very out of whack with the equation with the progressives. You know, I was on the Young Turks Network, which is a far left YouTube channel. And every single day we'd go on air and basically just call everybody a racist and everybody a bigot and everybody a homophobe. And I actually, in my book, I lay out a couple of the instances where I really woke up. But one of them was we were on air covering a guy by the name of David Webb, who you might know. He's a SiriusXM host on the Patriot Channel. He's on Fox News often. He's a conservative who happens to be Black. And we were showing a clip of him on Fox News. And my other hosts, these tolerant lefties, were talking about how he was an Uncle Tom and a sellout and all these horrible things. And what they didn't know was that I was good friends with David Webb, because I used to have a show on SiriusXM before that. And I was a lefty at the time and David was on the right, but we would go on each other's shows and we'd debate stuff. And then we'd go downstairs to Del Frisco's and have a steak and have some whiskey. And I know that he is a good man who believes in what he talks about. But here I had these, again, so-called tolerant progressives saying, oh, that Black man who doesn't think the way we think all Black people should think, he must be the worst of all things. And in that moment, it so crystallized to me who the bigots are, who the real racists are. And who's using prejudice, right? Prejudice is to prejudge. Well, they see black man and they think, oh, black man must think this way. And as I said before, I think black people can think all sorts of different things. That doesn't mean they're right, but you can think all sorts of different things and it shouldn't be dictated by the color of their skin. So that was one of several instances that really just were like a smack in the face to me because I knew him. It wasn't just like someone on TV. It was like, no, you're actually talking about my friend and he's not a sellout and he's not self-hating or whatever else you might be saying about him.
Right. Love David Webb. And what I really admire about him is he's intellectually honest.
Yeah.
And that's also something that I admire about you. And so you were a progressive. It's one thing to say, hey, the progressives think that people should act in a sort of in a monolithic manner. They should act. You got to act your skin color now. You got to act your sexuality yeah. now, or you don't belong. But then there's quite a leap from that to conservative values, small government, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, I think what happened to me was as I started seeing how bananas the left was going, I started talking to some conservatives, and progressives generally don't talk to conservatives. Conservatives very often, and I see this now, are willing to talk to the other side. The other side is rarely willing to talk to conservatives because they've labeled them all Nazis. And why would you sit down with Nazis? And that's one of the things that I started calling out as a lefty. I kept saying, hey, we got to stop doing this because it's not what we're doing to them. It's what we're doing to ourselves. We're painting ourselves into a corner here. I was warning about this with Trump. I kept saying to everybody, you know, you got to stop calling this guy Hitler because A, he's not Hitler. And we use these over the top ridiculous comparisons. But what if you find out a few years into the Trump presidency that it's actually pretty good, that the economy's going and we're not going to extra wars and things are all right? It's like, well, you can't suddenly be like, you know, that Hitler guy is actually not that bad. So it's more what you're doing to yourself than what you're doing to them. As for the movement, well, then I started talking to some conservatives and I talked to Ben Shapiro and I talked to Larry Elder and I talked to Dennis Prager, all the scary conservative names. And what I found was I disagreed with them on some stuff, but they were completely willing to have the conversation and be open and agree to disagree. And then what I realized is these people are also much nicer. They're much kinder. They're much more generous of spirit and time. And liberals, and I say this with all due irony, but liberals generally are afraid of their own shadow. They want to be liked desperately, almost as the most important thing. And conservatives, I think, take the world more seriously. And I think because of that, they have a better cohesive view of the world. And I'm interested in that.
Well, I think they're sort of wrestling with the world and the liberals want to have it decided so that they don't have to think about it anymore and they can maybe just get on with stuff.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that my main focus is education.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at an education summit recently and we were talking about, you know, how to fix it. And I think that one of the big problems that we have is that we've got teachers' unions that really sort of run the show. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on that. If you've looked into it, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I've done a couple shows on this, including one that you were on, just about teachers' unions and their completely out of control amount of power. And then especially how that really is deeply connected to Democrat politics, especially in New York and in California. I mean, California has a really particularly nefarious brand of that. I mean, as a general rule, one of the last things that I would say sort of allowed me to say I was still liberal was that I believed in public education. I come from public education. I went to, you know, elementary, junior high school. I went to a blue ribbon high school. I went to State University of New York at Binghamton. You know, it's a public school in New York. I got a pretty good education, although I did come out a political lefty, so maybe not a perfect education, but in essence, I believe that there was some role for the state. Now, in the last year and a half, between COVID and lockdowns and locking, you know, just kids at home and critical race theory and 1619 Project and the series of deeply anti-American ideas, not even deeply anti-American, ideas that are antithetical to freedom and the very founding of this country. I mean, that's the purpose of the 1619 Project. After seeing that so infect every level of our education system, now literally we're talking about it in kindergarten, and they're probably bringing it into preschool in ways we can't even imagine too. But then watching that work all the way up, I don't know how I can at this point call for any level of public education. I'm basic, you know, first off, I'm for school choice, so I think charter schools are great. I think we should have as much school choice as possible. I think there's going to be well, we know this is happening already, a growing homeschool movement. And then I would be for what Corey DeAngelis, who when you were on my show, he was on as well, is all about, which is that we should be funding students and not schools. So, you know, each parent gets X amount of dollars for that child. They have to use it towards education, but they get to make the choice around that. Because at this point, to send your kids to public school, and I get not everybody has the means not to do it. So that's why we have to deal with choice and funding kids and all that. But to send your kids to public school, you're in essence sending them to be brainwashed. I mean, your kids could literally come home and after a week in a public school and start telling you that you're racist, you're part of the patriarchy, you know, your family is evil, and just the horrific litany of things that we all now know. So it's interesting, because if we had had better education, I suppose, a better educational system for the last however many decades, we probably wouldn't be in this situation. But now nobody knows anything. People don't know basics about history. They don't know basics about economics. 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4 anymore. So we're watching the entire thing collapse. And of course, what's the left answer to it? More money. Just give it more money and then they'll magically turn around.
Yeah, I think part of the problem, and I don't want to park here for too long, but part of the problem is now that teachers have been taught all of this. And so they're insisting on the woke culture. I'll call it the woke culture in the classroom. And I was talking to somebody just this weekend, and her daughter was married to a Black man. She's white. The daughter is biracial. And so the school is teaching her daughter that she is oppressed by her mother. And the woman marched down there and said, you're basically teaching my daughter that I'm oppressing her because I'm white. But what you don't understand is she's oppressed by her father, who left us when she was 2 years old. Ooh, a Black guy. Ooh,
like, how'd they take that? Not very well.
You know, you can't call people out on an ideology that's so deeply ingrained. And so, you know, I see this as a bigger problem than that. And then I just want to mention that it occurs to me that when something is for free, is it valued? No, right?
Not really. That's the idea, why Bernie wants free college.
Right. Right, which will be the death sentence for college in certain respects, although because it's all bureaucratized now and the government's involved, it's a bigger problem than that, right?
Well, of course. First off, you know, when they tell you they want free college, okay, we know nothing's free, but they just love the bumper sticker slogan. It's free. All right. Free, what do you mean? Like, are we paying the janitor? What about the professors? Like, someone's right. getting paid.
And that's no, right. Nobody's like that's, earning anything.
Right. They say these things all the time, and it's just meaningless, but it sort of sounds right if you're not thinking. So a young person that's 15, they hear Bernie Sanders say, I want free college for everybody. And it's like, oh, that sounds good. Why shouldn't I be allowed to go to free college? But then, of course, someone has to pay for the electricity. Someone's got to pay the lady in the lunchroom. Like, somebody's got to pay for some of this stuff. And what he means is we as the government will take from people we don't like and don't agree with, who in most cases are the producers, the main drivers of the economy. And then we will pay people to teach the things we want to teach. This is the key part. Bernie Sanders does not want free college so that kids can go to college to learn all sorts of different ideas. He's not sending them to college so that they can read a Thomas Sowell book on economics. But if you wanted to train the next generation of Marxists and socialists, where would a better place to be to send them than free state education? I mean, it sounds right out of communist 101, right? Like the state should educate them for free to teach them what the state wants. And yet when Bernie says it, people think he's somehow being good. He's tricked people into thinking that virtue, that selfishness in essence is a virtue, which is a really dangerous idea. But it seems to have just solidified around almost everyone on the left.
So that's a really great way of putting it. In fact, I get into arguments with people who think that communism is good. And I finally say, communism is great as long as you can solve the selfishness problem. Once you can, you know, get rid of human selfishness, we'll be fine if we're communist. Like, communism would be great. But the problem is
you're going to have to kill a lot of humans.
What's that?
You'd have to kill a lot of humans to do it.
Well, you have to eliminate selfishness, which you cannot do.
Yeah.
Like you first, you know, like,
well, that's
not going to go anywhere.
That's the thing. They'll tell you right now, if you were to listen to the average sort of BLM, communist, Marxist, whatever you want to call it, they would tell you capitalism doesn't work because humans are selfish, right? They would say Jeff Bezos is selfish. Jeff Bezos, who's created extraordinary wealth, not only for himself, but for hundreds of thousands of people. And by the way, when Jeff Bezos buys a $500 million yacht, all sorts of people get paid to work on that yacht, to build the yacht and everything else. Now, we could have some philosophical argument about, you know, is there amount that is too much? Now, I don't like the idea of the government coming in and taking it from him, really, just to put it to their pet projects. But we could have a philosophical argument on that. But somehow they think that capitalism doesn't work because people are too selfish, but communism will work.
Right.
Despite that same thing in human nature. This is a major flaw in the argument.
Government people aren't selfish.
That's the difference,
Dave. You got to understand when you get into government, you stop being selfish and you just work for the people. That's why none of our government officials take a salary.
None of them take a salary. None of them get richer. Do any of our politicians get richer while they're in government? Could that possibly be?
Do you think any of them get richer? Exactly. So what you were saying before about free college, I extrapolate down the line. And I think it's problematic that parents are under the impression that public school is free, because then they basically don't value it. And the children also won't be valuing the stuff that they're getting for free, like all the information that they're being fed. And that's actually can be our saving grace, because I think the youth of today are deeply skeptical about what they're being taught, because they're naturally skeptical and it really doesn't pass the smell test.
Well, what you're talking about there is the beauty of the human mind, that there in essence are young people now who are being brought up in a time where truth is being destroyed. I mean, we're in this reality war. Truth, it would almost, when you hear someone tell the truth, it's so refreshing, because you're like, oh my God, nobody tells the truth anymore, right? Yes. That's why Jordan Peterson, lit up the world the way that he did, because he was a man telling some simple truths in a rather deep way. But in a normal time, if things were pretty good, Jordan may not have become Jordan, because people would have been like, oh, he's just saying what's obvious. But in a dark time, simple truths mean a lot. But I love what you're saying there, because to me, and I see this, by the way, I see this with, I've seen this when I talk to some of my interns who are, 18, 19 years old. They have a massive distrust of virtually everyone before them. And that's, by the way, that's kind of depressing, because it shows you that we have all dropped the ball at some level. But what it also shows you is there's something about the human mind that knows what's right, that knows what's true, and it will put more of a burden on them to build a better world, on top of the fact they got to fight the wokesters, just generally speaking, and the mayhem on the streets and all that. But I'm enthused, because the human spirit is what will get us through this thing. It's not the government that's going to get us through this thing.
Right. So we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back from the break, or if you're listening on radio, the rest of this show you can find over at Locals. Go to sorbos.locals.com. I'm going to ask Dave about why wealthy people are socialist, also about the government now competing with minimum wage, and finally, why I haven't heard him declare for governor of California. Stay tuned.
I am joined by a very special guest. We're going to talk about what is between the covers. Now, before you think that that's something dirty, it is. For clarity, I'll be clear. It's very dirty. And it is what is happening in children's books today. With me is the author of this fantastic book. I recommend it. You should get it, especially if you're a grandma, a grandpa, or parents of young children, because you need to know the smut that they're reading. And I use the word smut fairly liberally, because anything that isn't good, solid literature is smut to me. I'm a bit judgmental that way. Deborah DeGroff joins me right now. Deborah, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me today.
Okay, so I want to start at the beginning. You wrote this book, and in the beginning of the book, you actually compare and contrast what used to be children's literature and what it has become. Now, the thing that surprised me here was it started morphing well before the 1950s, before the 1920s, well before the turn of the century, actually. And that shocked me. So I do want to go back and talk about that. But I just want to, at the end of the very first chapter of the book, she compares the first sentences of two different children's books. One was written well in advance, and the other was written after this sort of shift began. I'll just compare two different sentences. One sunny morning, early in March, two children, a boy and a girl, followed by a large shaggy dog, slowly sauntered up Rue Royale in the French Quarter of New Orleans. That's the first sentence in one book. The first sentence in the later book is, the Bobbsey twins were very busy that morning.
Yes.
And so what we're going to talk about today is why it makes a difference. But then we're also going to delve into content. So start off with really the crux of the book, which is where you start in the book. Let's start there, shall we?
Well, when I started to write this book, I was actually encouraged not to include those first three chapters, but I felt like they were foundational to anything that we would deal with content. You have to know how we got there, which is our foundations, to know how we've ended up where we are today with the contemporary literature. And it was strategically done, actually. You have to know these people were brilliant. They have much more patience than we do. These things were set up. They took time. You're well aware that they stripped phonics away.
That's the big one for me. Dr. Seuss, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, later in that 1981 interview with Arizona Magazine, he said that was the worst thing that ever happened, was throwing out phonics and replacing it with Chinese pictographs. But what it did was it brought about a controlled vocabulary. Now, when you taught your children to read.
Hold on. Stop right there. Mm-hmm. Controlled vocabulary. Like, you mean what Facebook is doing, not allowing people to talk about vaccine hesitancy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everything that they've ever accused us of, they have a precedence for it long before. But people could argue that we used a controlled vocabulary when we taught our kids, but we didn't. Beyond the fact we didn't give them words with long vowel sounds before we had taught them the rules, say, for example, of short vowel sounds. So if all we had taught them was the readers that we had that went along with that only had short vowel sounds. But this was a method of you were teaching them to read while they were learning the rules. You didn't start out with teaching our children words that ended with T-I-O-U-S. Okay, you started out with simple, usually consonant vowels.
Or O-U-G-H, frankly. But that's just, look, that's always the sort of the resort of the radicals, is to say, well, they'll learn it eventually anyway. Why don't you just give it to them up front? Like sex. Like, why aren't we teaching our, you know, first and second graders about sex? Like, why not? Well, because we protect our children till when it's developmentally reasonable to have that conversation with them, right?
That's exactly right. But when they use the controlled vocabulary, if you grew up in Georgia and I grew up in Maine and we both moved to Ohio next year and we're in the same second grade, we would have had to have known the same words. So the vocabulary had to be controlled to make sure that the readers you had in Georgia and the readers I had in Maine basically covered the same word list. Okay, so you were very limited in your vocabulary. You would learn the word airplane before you learned the word up, which was actually two books later before you learned up, because airplane was easier to recognize and went along with the pictures.
Right.
That's a controlled vocabulary.
And up, frankly, is a concept that's more difficult to draw out. When it's a concrete object, it's much more easy to illustrate. But let's fast forward, because I don't want to get mired in, and I've talked about on this show, I've talked about phonics and how we've sort of dumbed things down. And so we started with this idea that they began back in the 1800s, and maybe even earlier than that. There is a push to infantilize people in order to control them, right? And so they started with this idea of basically limiting the learning capacity of children with the types of reading that they're doing. And in fact, this coming year, I'm going to be teaching, and we're doing Paradise Lost, which I hesitate to admit, but is a book that I hadn't read before. It is very difficult. And by difficult, all I mean is it requires a good deal of concentration.
Yes.
That is seemingly, that's the difficulty, is we're asking children to learn to concentrate. And that is really part of the fundamental building blocks that children learn or should be learning as they're being educated, is simply the ability to concentrate, right? Because the idea with education is that we create problem solvers, people who can think and think enough about something to come up with a solution. Otherwise, there's no progress. So let's leave that and go into the content, which is what, and the book is, so I'm going to show it again, Between the Covers. It's a large book, but it's not terribly thick. Between the Covers, of course, references something else, because now we're delving into content, right?
Yes, Between the Covers of a Children's Book. And let's face it, most parents who are conscientious of what their children are learning consider movies, they consider video games, and they either choose to let their children watch certain things and not other things. But when it comes to books, we've been sold a bill of goods that anything reading is safe and neutral, and nothing could be further from the truth. This is how our children have been indoctrinated. These were part of the communist platform.
Right. So, and by the way, you mentioned the word indoctrination. It's sort of a brainwashing, because we all went to school. And so we all were told, we were indoctrinated, we were brainwashed with the idea that school knows best, period, full stop, school knows best. So don't question the school. Mm-hmm. And so if the teachers put in these books into the classroom, and we're going to get to that in a minute, the parents are supposed to just go along. Oh, well, if you got it from the school, it must be okay. So I'm going to take a very short break here. And so the rest of this content will be at sorbos.locals.com. For radio, just stay put. I'll be right back with the rest of the show. And Deborah DeGroff, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Just a quick break here. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. My guest now is Peter McCullough. He's an MD, an MPH, bear with me, an FACP, FACC, FCCP, FAHA, FNKF, FNLA, FCRSA. In fact, he invented his own alphabet, which is, no, I'm kidding. He wrote a paper that took the world by storm, if you will. It's called Pathophysiological Basis and Rationale for Early Outpatient Treatment of SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. And so I wanted to bring him on here to talk about, first of all, what he found, what his paper disclosed, and then the reaction to it. So welcome to the program. Should I call you Dr. Peter?
That's fine. Thank you, Ms. Sorbo. It's a pleasure to be on the show. And as introduced, I'm a professor of medicine, an internist, cardiologist, and epidemiologist in Dallas, Texas. I see and examine patients every day, but I'm also an author and editor. And I felt compelled, given a giant vacuum in clinical practice in the literature. And the vacuum was that patients who were developing COVID were getting no guidance or treatment in order to prevent hospitalization and death.
Right. And what we found now, I followed this fairly closely. I'm slightly medically minded. And so I was watching this, and I noticed there were a number of reports that said that if you were put on a ventilator, basically that would be the kiss of death, that venting patients was, in a sense, not prescribed unless it was absolutely necessary, because it's very difficult to get off the trach, right?
Well, early on, actually, patients were intubated too early. Doctors and nurses were trying to protect the spread of the virus. So there was aggressive early intubation, which really turned out to be a disaster. Now patients delay ventilation as much as possible, but that's really prolonged the length of stay. And the current contemporary mortality of someone who ends up in the ICU, ventilator or no, is 38% in America. It's unacceptably high. People need to understand COVID-19 is not an illness that you wait to go into the hospital to start treatment. The key principle is start early. And that's what we put in our paper in August of 2020. I collaborated with Italians in Milan who had also just gotten socked with COVID-19, and it became clear that drugs were having emerging signals of benefit. No single drug was a cure, but there was emerging signals of benefit. And just like with AIDS and hepatitis C and other illnesses, we put drugs into combination. And in fact, they do get patients through the illness and help them avoid hospitalization and death.
So you call it SARS-CoV-2, meaning there was a SARS that predated this one. How's the vaccine on that one working?
Well, we now have come to a really disturbing realization, and that is virus called SARS, or sudden acute respiratory distress syndrome. SARS-CoV-1 probably was naturally occurring, but SARS-CoV-2 is not. SARS-CoV-2, I think all listeners at this point would understand, is a product of bioterrorism research. And the research was done to change the spike protein. The dangerous part of the virus is the little spicule or the spiky structure on the ball of the virus that people have all come to see on TV. That's actually what damages blood vessels, causes blood clotting, causes a variety of horrible things in the body. So everybody listening who had COVID and survived, in a sense, survived a botched attempt at bioterrorism. And what I've come to understand in the last few weeks is that the vaccines, all of them, actually trick the body into making this exact same dangerous protein, the spike protein, again, the product of bioterrorism. In a sense, we're now introducing this in people's bodies when we give the COVID-19 vaccine. Recent paper from Harvard shows that the vaccine causes the spike protein to circulate in the human body of a vaccine recipient for about 2 weeks.
It sounds like you're saying that the vaccine, any of them, are counterindicated.
I'm not saying that. I have to tell you, my thinking has evolved. When the vaccine program was early in its development, it was truncated to about 2 months. They recruited well individuals. People had a way less than 1% chance of getting COVID, whether they had the vaccine or not. So it was really odd. I mean, we were having 5, 10, 15% COVID positivity rates in labs, and somehow Pfizer, Moderna, and then later J&J found miraculously, they found people who basically didn't come in contact with COVID. That became the vaccinated population. And in the studies, the vaccines looked reasonably clean. It looked like they had some severe injection reactions, but that was it. And then, wow, when they hit the market, I have to tell you, as an internist and cardiologist, I use vaccines in my practice. I've gotten all the vaccines myself, pro-vaccine, if you will. 70% of my patients have been vaccinated in practice, but that's in December, January, and February. And I can no longer recommend it generally for the following reasons. We have now accumulated over 4,200 American deaths after the vaccine, over 12,000 hospitalizations, and tens of thousands of serious safety events requiring clinic visits and ER visits. That exceeds all the other vaccines, all the other 70 vaccines we have. It exceeds all of those numbers per year for every year that those vaccines have been in existence. So the COVID-19 vaccine will go down.
Okay. And we're calling it a vaccine, but my understanding is that it's basically new technology. So it's not a vaccine in the traditional sense of what a vaccine is. But these products by Moderna and Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, that's, I think, not, it's disallowed in the United States. The damages that we have reported from those vaccines exceed the cumulative damages of all the other vaccines that we've had for measles and mumps and rubella and polio.
It exceeds the damages incurred from all vaccines for all time. This is very important. And America heard a glimpse of this about 2 weeks ago. Tucker Carlson came out on a monologue that I helped him prepare for, and he had all the data, and he presented this to the American public for all time. And this is what's reported in the vaccine event reporting system. And the CDC on its website continues to tell Americans, go look at VAERS, tells doctors, that this is where the safety data is given. These products are not approved, so there's no safety information given in the package insert. It's a blank. So the only way for Americans to learn about safety is to go to VAERS. Fortunately, there's a very convenient overlay now called openvaersdata.com. I'll send you the link afterwards. Americans click on that. You see a scoreboard of what's happened, and you'll see the deaths, the heart attacks, the abortions, the miscarriages. It makes sense because the spike protein, the product of bioterrorism, is circulating in the human body after a vaccine for about 2 weeks, causing tremendous damage in some people who probably can't shut off the production of the spike protein biologically.
Okay, so Facebook will shut this down because you're not allowed to express any kind of vaccine hesitancy. But I'm trying to follow a lead here. It seems like these new products are inducing the replication of a spike protein in the human body. And your contention is that the spike protein is the difficult part, the challenging part, the attack part or the weapon of the SARS-CoV-19 virus, and that the virus was the result of a gain of function research. You haven't used gain of function yet, but this is the new buzzword that's in the news now, because even Fauci has admitted that, oh, maybe it was some gain of function research. Wall Street Journal reported on it. And my understanding is that we are now, quote, allowed to speak about it on Facebook, which I find so amazing. But if I'm tying all these things together, the virus is a bioweapon that was designed in a lab, and the quote unquote vaccines are inducing replication of that same bioweapon in human beings currently. Is that correct?
It is the scariest set of understanding that we've come to understand basically in about the last 2 weeks. This is a recent congealing of information from science, from investigative reporters. But as you've laid it out, it's as if Americans and people in the world, if you weren't hit by chapter number one of bioterrorism, which was the infection, COVID-19, now you're going to be hit almost under duress or by mandate by chapter number two, which is vaccination with the bioterroristic weapon. And so the mindset of people are now are just so dead set on getting everyone exposed to fundamentally a weapon of bioterrorism, a weapon of destruction, and people will be lost. It's so predictable now. There are calculations from VAERS. Listen to this. If we force American college kids to get the vaccine, and we have 20 million kids going to college, we will lose 80 college kids to the vaccine. They'll die, and another 1,000 will be put in the hospital. These are very solid estimates now. I think Americans...
Hold on, 80, just 80 overall of the, I don't know how many, you know, a million college kids? What?
No, it's going to be 80. It's going to be 20 million college kids get vaccinated. We're going to lose 80, and then we'll have 1,000 be hospitalized, and we'll probably have tens of thousands get really sick and miss school for a period of days. That's how the numbers work out. And for a benefit... That's not there. There's fundamentally no benefit in doing this. Risking even a single life is over the line, in my view.
So this is pretty groundbreaking, earth-shattering, and I want to talk to you some more. I'm going to take a quick break. If you want the rest of this interview, go to sorbos.locals.com. For radio listeners, just stay tuned. I'll be right back. I want to talk about real estate in the United States right now, because really, the markets are going kind of crazy. And that's because COVID has precipitated an enormous flux, an enormous, a current, a tide, if you will, almost a tsunami of movement. And this was sort of brought home to me just the other day. I was chatting with some friends who live out in California. They had their house on the market a while ago. It didn't sell. They took it off the market. They decided, well, we'll keep it for a while. They have extended family that used the house and stuff like that. It was sort of a secondary home. And then they decided to put it back on the market, and they just got an offer for 25% more than what the home was listed for last, like a year ago or 2 years, maybe more because of COVID, 2 years ago. Okay.
which is crazy because California is losing people. There's a net loss of people in California, and yet here they are, and it looks like they're going to sell their house now. And so I was tooling around on Twitter, actually. I saw a tweet from somebody, and I thought, okay, that's interesting. And I noticed this guy, Glenn Kelman, who happens to be the CEO of Redfin, and he has a whole Twitter feed about what's happening in the market right now. And I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. And I'd like to share that with you guys because actually I have some very good friends who are involved in real estate. So Glenn Kelman is the CEO of Redfin. Redfin is a realty agency. They have realtors. You call them, they'll sell your house for you. And their business plan is to basically completely undercut the rest of the realtor market with much, much lower commission rates. Of course, they promise excellent service and all that other stuff to make them competitive, but they have very low commission rates. He starts with this. He's got a Twitter feed, as long as my arm, is about 15 tweets. It has been hard to convey through anecdotes or data how bizarre the U.S. housing market has become. And then he gives this example. He said in Bethesda, Maryland, there was a home buyer who was working with one of his agents, and somebody included in their offer a pledge to name her firstborn child after the seller. She lost. But still, like, people are making offers in order to stand out because there has been such a tremendous shift. I know in my state of Florida, I have friends who want to move here. And what they're finding is that they have to move so quickly if they want the house. They can't dilly-dally because there are six offers before sundown the first day that the house goes on the market. And there are offers even before the house gets on the market if somebody catches wind of it. He also tweeted, there are more realtors now than listings. Yeah, we're having, there's just less on the market. Inventory is down 37% year over year. It is now at a record low. Inventory means the number of houses that are currently available to purchase. The typical home sells in 17 days, which is also a record low. That's a really fast sale rate. Home prices are up a record amount, 24% over last year, and that is a record high. And still, homes sell on average for 1.7% higher than the asking price, which is also a record. So we're setting all of these real estate records. And I can only think, well, you'll see. I think we'll have a little bit of an answer from some of his later tweets. He said in two of America's largest cities, inventory actually is a net gain. It's increased. What are those two cities? New York is up on inventory by 28%. San Francisco's inventory of available housing is up 77%. San Francisco hasn't had an inventory increase this large since 2008, when the big bubble burst. And yet in both markets, he writes, prices are increasing. Well, that's not going to last. I mean, if you have supply and demand, if you have too much supply, then the supply is going to lower their prices to meet the demand. If you have more supply than demand, it's going to lower their prices. Okay. In 2020, the new construction permits were down by 13% in DC and New York. They were down 40% in Los Angeles, down 48% in Chicago. They were down by 50% in the Redfin CEO's hometown of Chicago, of Seattle. They were down 79% in San Francisco. Permits were up 25% in Miami, 56% in Vegas, 96% in Greenville, 122% in Detroit, and 246% in Knoxville, Tennessee. But wait for this statistic. Lumber prices are up 300%. I love this guy because he's like just trying to accumulate all of this information and then you get all this data in and you go, okay, what do I do with it? Well, let's try to figure out what is it saying to us. So in Redfin's annual survey of nearly 2,000 home buyers, 63% reported that they had bid on a home that they never saw in person. Now, I couldn't buy a home. I couldn't do that. I don't know how people buy a home without actually walking through it. Because to me, there's a visceral vibe thing that happens. But when the market is so tight and you don't have a chance, like you just can't get there. And if you're working and you're moving and, you know, I get it. I understand it. But wow. In an April survey of 600 Redfin.com users who had relocated in the past year, he says about 2/3 of the people who moved got a house the same size or bigger. But about the same proportion, 2/3, spent the same or less on housing. So some of them downsized, but some of them upsized and were paying more and were paying less, which is a pretty sort of alarming statistic. It seems like even though home prices are going up, they're actually not downsizing. They're just moving to less expensive housing, which indicates that they're moving out of cities and more into non-city environments, because it's the more congested areas that are higher priced compared to the less congested areas for the same or better housing. I actually, our house here is slightly larger and a lot less expensive than the house in California. So that's me. I'm one of those statistics. He then writes, for low states, 4 people move in for every one that leaves. For Texas, the ratio is 5 to 1. For Florida, 7 to 1. Again, part of a statistic. Thank you. Cities and states have no leverage to raise taxes after many promised new money for social justice. The federal government will have to fund long-term investments. So that's interesting. That we might be reaching a kind of a government investment bubble. That's interesting. And I've said, you know, here in this state of Florida, we have so many people coming in, the government's going to have to do something to incentivize businesses, I believe. I don't know that that's the right thing to do, but I think if they want to avoid maybe some more critical issues, the government might consider doing something to stimulate or attract businesses. Although I haven't seen the statistic. Maybe there are a bunch of businesses that are also moving to this state. The migration to lower cost areas, he writes, may lead to lower workforce participation. For many families that his company has relocated, the money saved on housing costs lets one parent stop working. And he also said that they have a wave of customers who are retiring early. So that's interesting. And I wonder if you have the opportunity now to work from home. Oh, here's the silver lining. I don't know, maybe. If now, because of COVID, we've seen that people can work from home and do well. And so they're saving all that time on the commute, and the companies are saving on office space. And like, there's a lot of savings that are happening, both for the worker and for the corporation. But at the same time, if they can now afford for one parent to stay home, maybe that's homeschooling. Maybe they will see that they have an opportunity here to have a better home life, better family life, a more improved, right? And I've had some interesting sort of epiphanies that I'm going to go into in another episode. But there's still a lot to be learned from the ramifications of COVID and on education. And I'm kind of optimistic. I'm very excited about that. Okay, number 12 of 15. Lenders are calling employers to confirm that the home buyer will have permission to work remotely when the pandemic ends. So the lender is saying, okay, I see that you have this income and you're moving, but I don't know if your income will, you're telling me your income will continue. I'm going to double check you. Amazing.
rates are lower for loans on primary residences, and the lender also wants to make sure that the borrower actually plans to work after getting the loan. And I have a feeling that that's also incentivized by a government that pays people more to stay home than some of them can earn at the office. Number 13, the average housing budget for out-of-towners moving to Nashville was $720,000, which is 50%, roughly 50% higher than the locals' $458,000 budget. So it used to be, he writes, coastal elites who worried that every adult in the family had to win a career lottery just to afford a home. But now that feeling may spread because of the tremendous wealth that is coming into communities. And that wealth will then raise the prices. That's the big problem. I mean, there are many problems with the fact that the government is paying people on the auspices of COVID, you know, reconciliate COVID remedies, right? The government is paying people so much to stay home. It rivals $15 an hour. And there are a lot of areas in the United States that don't have the $15 an hour, quote, minimum wage. I always like to put minimum wage in air quotes because the minimum wage is zero. That's the minimum wage, unless you pay somebody to work for them. And yet we have this, you know, the progressives are full of all of these sort of, euphemisms. Nice words for nasty, nasty things. Minimum wage is a nasty, nasty thing. And yeah, so the minimum wage is being rivaled by or defeated by our very own government. So two things will happen. One, employers will have to raise the wages that they're paying their employees. They'll have to. In fact, Dave Rubin was recently on and he said that in his town, which he lives somewhere in California, if you go down the main drag, you'll see all of these places that have help wanted signs because they can't find anybody to come to work, especially for the quote unquote minimum wage type jobs, right? So it's not just income that's K-shaped, he writes, but mobility is K-shaped. 90% of people earning $100,000 plus per year expect to be able to work virtually. If you compare that to the 10% of those who are earning $40,000 or less per year, who think that they have mobile capabilities, virtual working capabilities. Well, that's because lower income jobs, menial jobs, tend to be location specific. So if you're a plumber, and I'm not saying that plumbers are, you know, but it's a hands-on job. So you got to live near your job site. But if you're and actually that's not entirely true. These are the statistics, right? If you're a receptionist in an office, you can't move. So the lower income jobs tend to be less flexible in terms of mobility and where people can live. He writes, the folks who need low-cost housing the most have the least flexibility to move. Well, that's true. And yet, when you put restrictions on housing prices, it's like it's a minimum wage that we call rent control. The cities that implement the strictest rent control standards are the cities with the highest low-income housing, like the housing for the everyman is skyrocketing because of the pressure that the rent control puts on the market. So it's a disastrous policy. And we ought to be evaluating policies based on their merits, and we don't. Okay, number 15, and then I'll have to close. An investor recently said, with an ancient touch of awe, but also greed, that one source of America's miraculous economic recovery was the bounty of the quote land itself. And he writes, we have more room to grow than we ever imagined. We just have to make sure that benefits everyone. So that seems to be his point of view. I don't know where he stands politically. He lives in Seattle, but he's a businessman and he's in real estate. So I find that hard to believe. I think that he's misinterpreting. I mean, I don't know what the quote was, but the investor who said that it's an amazing thing that our economic recovery is also based on how great the land is that we sit on. And I would argue that that's true. I mean, all of our economics is based on that. So I don't know that you could say that that wouldn't be true. Of course it's true. That said, our economic recovery is really reliant on the capitalist system. And the more that the socialists can impede economic growth, which is all they do, regulations and more regulations, that's what they do. The more they're allowed to impede the economic growth, the longer and harder the recovery will be. That's basically all I'm going to say about that. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. Check out check out my Locals channel, sorbos.locals.com, for more content. And don't forget to subscribe. And if you don't see this on YouTube, then you should go to YouTube, because I put on a nice shirt for you. And I actually did my hair. So you can check it out on YouTube and also Rumble. I do want to encourage people, go over to Rumble, subscribe on Rumble, because I don't know how long YouTube's going to keep me around. I'm so woke. All right. I'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.